Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcasts on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Morning, Francis. How are you doing today?
I'm well, well indeed.
Hey, I just want to make, before we get started, I want to make an announcement to our local listeners at CTC. There's a very good event happening down in Princeton. It's called Taste of the Nation, and they do them in all over the world. We actually participate in the one in Manhattan. But there's one coming up next Monday, June 12th, at the Westin Princeton at Forest Hill Village. And it's a great event for hunger.
Yeah, a bunch of New Jersey chefs are going to be there serving samples of their food, and the proceeds all go to benefit
various causes for hunger. You can buy tickets at www.princetonontaste.org or telephone 609-924-3663 to buy tickets to that event, and a very good event for a very good cause.
Yeah, 100%. I participated in the New York one, which was interesting. I mean, I live up in Jersey City, and a lot of my friends are in the New York restaurant business, so... I was a sommelier up, a guest free, meaning free sommelier guy up there. And, these events go, Taste of the Nation is probably the top one.
Oh, I think for sure. But for sure, Taste of the Nation is number one.
You know, I don't know. I think I'm a little jaded to these Taste of This, Taste
you
of That
jaded.
Events.
You are jaded. No doubt about it.
Well, but I mean, to this Taste of This, Taste of That event, I don't know. It's not related to what
right.
goes
we've
on
talked
in the restaurant.
We've talked about this before in that a lot of times what restaurants will do is they feel that they're donating their service or they're donating their food, and because they already feel that they're donating, they don't invest very much into the product, and then they don't put their best foot forward. And frequently you'll go to these events and see less than what the restaurant actually does, though I think Taste of the Nation is the best of
right.
Of
Taste
these.
Of the Nation is the exception to that rule. But you know, it's interesting because it's great to be able to go and meet the chef, you know, and meet the people at the restaurant, and also to be hang out and do something good and hang out with foodies for an evening. But you know, what you get handed to walk around and eat while you walk around is it's usually not related to very closely to what you have in a restaurant.
Well, it's catering food. You're serving in that type of atmosphere what you would serve in a catering hall or in someone's home versus what you have in your restaurant where you
which
may
plated
have...
and you can sit down and eat.
Yeah,
it.
And yeah. You may have $200,000 of kitchenware
right.
or $500,000 of kitchenware, I should say, $200,000 just in ovens in order to make that food where you may be working out of a chafing dish at one of these events.
Speaking of chafing dishes,
are you chafed?
No, I went to a place, I had the... good fortune to be in Manhattan on the east side, and I stopped by a place that's getting a lot of press called the Better Burger.
Mm-hmm.
Not so.
Come on, Francis. You're so mean.
The Better Burger, it looks good on paper, man. And he's opening a second. The guy who owns the Better Burger owns a couple other restaurants, opening a second location of the Better Burger. I don't know why, but it's everything in there is organic.
Well, people are looking
organic.
For a way to eat healthier, Francis.
Yeah, and eat healthier food that doesn't taste very good is not really a sustainable way to eat healthier. Mm-hmm. What we're all about is making great food that's good for you and tastes great. So I walk into the Better Burger, and it's all they have veggie burgers. I don't know how they are. Maybe they're good. Maybe that's what I should have had.
Mm-hmm.
But they have grass-fed burgers. Now, grass-fed beef, you got to cook carefully, and you cannot cook too well done, or it's a hockey puck. And I had a hockey puck.
Oh.
$5.95 fast food hamburger hockey puck.
hey, you know,
I don't mind the cost.
You want to pay for grass-fed beef, you want to pay for some of these ingredients, it's going to cost you more, Francis. Come on.
Of course it is, but if it tastes like dog water, why do I want to eat it?
you probably don't.
Yeah, okay. So I went in, I went into the Better Burger, and I liked the concept. I just did that Better Burger, not so better.
Mm-hmm.
And I had that, and I had air-dried fries that were air-cooked fries that were kind of...
Yeah, French fries really bad fries. For you, but... They got to be fried. Sorry. I'm a firm believer of that.
And then I had a smoothie, and the smoothie wasn't even very good. And then I had a cookie. And there was just like a cookie sitting there.
Mm.
And I picked up the cookie, and it looked delicious. And I thought I was going to salvage my meal with a little bit of dessert, and I bit into some awful thing. You know, I don't remember exactly what it was.
So my question to you is...
Milk replacer in there, the ingredients, and rice flour, and...
See, organic doesn't necessarily mean no milk. It doesn't mean it doesn't have to mean tofu only. They had grass-fed beef. Why didn't they have other types of ingredients like milk, for instance?
Well, I don't know. But the grass-fed beef they had wasn't very good. But
what was the matter with the smoothie?
It just tasted processed and it not very much. Look, smoothie, ice, fruit, mix it up, give it to me.
Smooth.
Smooth.
Smooth it out.
That's all I need. Now. So, yeah, that wasn't all very good. But I mean, we talked about restaurants like Pure Food and Wine that I went to a couple of weeks ago,
mm-hmm.
which is about, like, no meat, organic,
mm-hmm.
Raw even. And the idea is, I think sometimes people in the organic movement can take the religion of trying to follow those rules and not care enough about making sure that something's really great. Because the truth of the matter is, when you buy something fresh and locally and organic, you can make the best-tasting food much
right.
better than the processed.
And if we want to, and you mentioned it earlier, sustain this movement that's begun, and it's definitely begun, the way to sustain that movement is to make these things taste great. And the reality is, they do taste better. An organic
but they take more care.
Heirloom tomato tastes better. As long as it's taken care of.
But that's exactly what it is. The processed stuff is shelf-stable. That's
mm-hmm.
what agribusiness wants. That's the easiest thing to go for. And when you have grass-fed beef, I mean, there's a lot of bad, poorly butchered, poorly shipped, poorly stored grass-fed beef out there. But, you know, we had dinner with Gail Green last week, and she was saying that she went to Kraft Steak, Tom Colicchio's new place. And she said one of the most interesting things about it is they offer different kinds of beef, and she was with a larger party, and they sampled the grass-fed steak, the corn-fed steak, and she said the grass-fed was their choice, was the best steak on the table.
See, grass-fed, I would never say best, worst when you're talking about grass-fed versus corn-fed because they're so different. It's like saying I had this was the best piece of meat on the plate and one's tuna and one's steak. They're very different.
I say here's where I differ with you though. If you overcook
you differ with me in so many places.
If you overcook grass fed meat, it's
mm-hmm.
abominable.
Mm-hmm.
It's
true.
An abominable piece of shoe leather. When we come back, we're going to be talking with the author Janet Mandel about her book, Cooking from the Heart of Spain, The Food of La Mancha. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:15. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Cafe Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. Our guest today is Janet Mandel. She's a freelance journalist, and although she was born in America, she spent the last 40 years living in Spain. She's devoted herself to its cuisine and culture. She's the author of My Kitchen in Spain. Her newest book is Cooking from the Heart of Spain, Food of La Mancha.
Janet, welcome to the show.
Janet, do we have Janet? Seems as though we've lost Janet.
Oh, I'm here.
Oh, there you are. You're there. Maybe
we can hear you now.
We just couldn't hear you, but now we have you.
Okay. Hi.
So again, welcome to the show. Now you've done your first book on the Spanish kitchen in general, and now you've decided to focus on the food of La Mancha. Why La Mancha?
Well, several reasons. Certainly, I was inspired by the story of Don Quixote, the Cervantes story, because Cervantes talks a lot about food in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And also, it was an opportunity to give an in-depth look at a single region that's really hardly touched in other Spanish cookbooks.
You know, it's funny. You start your book with a quote, which is a famous quote from Cervantes, which is, hunger is the best sauce.
The best sauce.
Sounds better in Spanish, but it's good in English too. And I think that's largely true. Now, let's tell our listeners where La Mancha is. It's sort of just south of Madrid, and it's a vast region that's in the center of Spain.
That's right. It's the very central area that sort of actually includes Madrid, but Madrid being the capital, we have to make it sort of separate.
Mm-hmm.
It's the high plateau. It's, besides Don Quixote's stomping ground, it's also saffron country. It's where saffron is grown. It's home of Manchego cheese.
Mm-hmm.
It's also the world's biggest vineyard. More acres devoted to vineyards there than any place else in the world.
You know, it's funny. I remember there was an old quote by Victor Hugo about how he thought that the wine Valdepeñas, which comes from there, is one of the greatest wines in the world. I heartily disagree.
But it is good wine. And furthermore, the wines of Valdepeñas and of La Mancha are improving day by day. There are now some absolutely superb wines made in that region.
Yeah, our listeners have heard me talk about... I had the great good fortune to go over a number of times, or I was over once, and I like the bullfights in Madrid, so I go over whenever I can.
Oh, so you know the food, yeah.
I do, and I got to have dinner at the house of Carlos Fulcar, the Marquis de Grignon, who makes beautiful Syrah.
Really spectacular wine.
That we carry in the restaurant, which is, you know, really reinvigorating the quality side of the wine region from La Mancha.
Well, one of the things, I've got an interview with him in this new book that we're talking about, Cooking from the Heart of Spain, because I went along to see his wine estate, which is in the province of Toledo, which
mm-hmm.
is in La Mancha,
mm-hmm.
During the Vendimia, which is the grape picking harvest. And the book, in fact, has various, for example, I went to the saffron harvest as well as the grape picking and went to make cheese with a Manchego cheesemaker. So the book, besides good recipes, there's also some of the insights about where this food comes from.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about the saffron harvest?
Okay, well, La Mancha, since the time of the Moors, 500 years ago, 600 years ago, has grown saffron. Saffron is grown there. And it's saffron comes from a small crocus flower, a mauve-colored flower that blooms the end of October, and the flowers are hand-picked, and then what becomes the saffron are just the stigmas. Each little flower has three stigmas, and that's dried, and that becomes the little wisps of saffron that we buy as the spice.
Picking saffron must be the most monotonous job in the entire world.
Yes.
And
I gave it a try, yeah.
And that's why, it's like you worked all day. How much you got? 7 ounces?
You know? Hey, listen, I've got some homegrown, though. Yes,
really?
I brought some bulbs back and grew it in flower pots. On my terrace, yeah. I got about a gram of it.
You know, and it's funny,
we're
talking with saffron, if you're talking about why it's the most expensive spice in the world, and that's just the reason. It's because it's this,
it's
flower.
Each flower produces one featherweight stigma.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, three featherweight stigmas.
That are hand-picked, hand-extracted from the little flower.
So now we see why we always have saffron in paella, and we have saffron figuring so prominently in La Manchan cuisine. What other things set La Mancha cuisine apart from the rest of Spain, let's say, from Andalusia
Well, there are a lot of wonderful egg and cheese dishes. Like in Spain, a tortilla is a round, flat omelet. So there are various tortillas, like with potatoes, which makes a great tapa, and cheese dishes also, like, for example, a savory flan with cheese and ham in it.
You know, and speaking of ham, I mean, I think that it's funny, if you visit anywhere in Spain in general, but especially in Castilla-La Mancha, the dried hams, the jamón serrano, the jamón ibérico, they figure so prominently in the cuisine there.
And so superb, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that speaks to, you know, it's very hard to talk about, I think, Spanish food without talking about Spanish culture. And I don't want to get too into tapas because we only have a minute or so less. But, I mean, tapas figure prominently in Spanish food. But I think they're misused here in the United States a little bit when people try and do tapas.
Why so? How?
tapas are about being in a culture where at 5 o'clock or 6 o'clock you go and you go from place to place and you have little snacks and then you don't eat until 10 or 11 o'clock.
Oh, that's true. Yeah.
And the way that these people are using tapas recipes here is you come over to someone's house and they serve you tapas at 6 and dinner at 7. Mm-hmm. You know, or people go for tapas at 7 and then have dinner at 8. Or people have tapas for dinner.
Or you just have tapas all night long. Exactly. That's what I was just about to say.
You know?
Right. My Spanish friends say that tapas are only those little foods that you eat in a tavern, in a bar, a tapa bar, not at home. If they're at home, they're an aperitivo.
Mm-hmm.
And furthermore, you're supposed to eat them standing up. You don't sit at a table and have the little plates come to you. You stand at the bar or little tables and balance your little plate of food and your glass of wine.
And it's very social thing. I mean,
it's very social.
And so I think when people get tapas recipes, they find they don't translate so
something well. Something about sitting down at a dinner table for four and having tapas for dinner seems incongruous.
Yeah, that's right.
We're going to have to take a short break for a commercial. We're talking with Janet Mendel. Her book is Cooking from the Heart of Spain, The Food of La Mancha. We'll be talking more with her in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 1125.
Floors, walls, and lighting. The Restaurant Guys learned long ago that the key to making a space look great are floors, walls, and lighting. There's no tougher test to a carpet than a busy restaurant. From design to installation to cleaning, the Gillespie Group has handled the Restaurant Guys restaurant floors for more than 10 years. Designers know what looks great on the first day. Bob Gillespie knows what will continue to look great year after year. Gillespie doesn't just install carpets. Their quality clean division has experience and expertise to keep that carpet looking great. In our business, it's the details that matter. In your home or office, the details make a lasting impression. The Gillespie Group handles projects from large hotels to offices right down to your living room. Look down. Go on, look down. Right there by your feet. You see. You need the Gillespie Group. Call them at 732-254-5508 or visit them at thegillespiegroup.com. Tell them the Restaurant Guys sent you and get a free cleaning with any installation. Remember, it's Gillespie for carpet and flooring, 732-254-5508.
Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis, stage left in Catherine Lombardi restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. And we're talking with Janet Mendel about the food of Castilla-La Mancha in Spain, which is a wonderful place where food is really well integrated with the culture. You know, I was in Toledo, and I went a number of times, but when I was last there, I went to visit the Marquis de Grignon, and after dinner, he brought out some amazing marzipan desserts that were unlike any marzipan I've ever had anywhere in the world. I usually hate marzipan, and I loved it. Can you talk to us?
Yeah, you talk a little bit about marzipan in the book. So.
Yeah. About Castilian marzipan?
Yeah. Spanish marzipan is nothing more than ground almonds and sugar or honey. Whereas I think the marzipan you get in other places is—I can't really speak for other places, but anyway, it's very, very good. It's just almonds.
Mm-hmm. And it figures pretty prominently in the cuisine and the desserts of the place. It's like a signature of the place almost. You know, they were very proud of that.
Toledo especially. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, and it wasn't carved even into a little animal like I normally get my marzipan around here at Christmas time.
Yeah, it's enchanting though. They make little figures and they make a great spiral and they what do they call that? An eel, I think. A great spiral of marzipan. It's important at Christmas time.
It's very carvable,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah. It's great. It's like Play-Doh, actually. You can let the kids mold it.
Okay,
there's a recipe for in the book in Cooking from the Heart of Spain for some almond rings that are melindres, that are marzipan cookies, actually,
mm-hmm.
that are just gorgeous. Yeah, they're so easy to make and very just delicious.
And the melindres are kind of like somewhere between somewhere between macaroons and pinoli cookies without the pinolis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And if I start letting my kids play with this stuff like it's Play-Doh, I'm sunk. Okay, because I'm gonna have marzipan in the hair. I'm gonna have marzipan. They're gonna be on a marzipan sugar high. I'm dead.
When we come back after the news, will you share with our listeners some of the kinds of things that they can find in your book that they can cook at home and sort of recreate the food of Castilla-La Mancha?
Okay.
All right, great. We'll be back in just a moment after the news. Our guest is Janet Mandel. Her book is Cooking from the Heart of Spain, The Food of La Mancha. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 1130.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal here with Francis Schott. Together we own Stage Left Restaurant in New Brunswick, New Jersey, as well as Captain Lombardi Restaurant. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon, reach us through restaurantguysradio.com, or download our podcast on iTunes.
Janet Mandel is our guest today. Her book is called Cooking from the Heart of Spain, The Food of La Mancha.
Janet, you wrote in your book, I have lived in Spain for many years and love its food from the inside out. La Mancha for me is the real Spain. This is Spanish cooking true to its roots and enticing in its future. The heart of Spain. What about La Mancha made you feel this way?
Well, it is the heartland. It's the very center. And it's not spoiled by tourism, that's one thing. And also, the other thing I meant was, like, we hear so much about Basque cooking and Catalan cooking. Well, those are almost separate countries within Spain, whereas La Mancha is Castilla-La Mancha, the original central Castilian heartland of the country. So I think its cooking is more representative of what Spanish cooking really is.
Yeah, you know, I think that is very true, because I've sort of traveled in Spain quite a bit myself, and it's interesting when you go to a Spanish quote unquote restaurant in the United States, it's Castilian derived food that you find here, but there are so many different regions of Spain that they were separate countries at different times, like Catalonia and Andalusia. But I agree that
we often think of paella as being like the national dish of Spain. Well, in fact, paella in its origin came from the Valencia area, mm-hmm. and it now maybe you can find it anywhere in Spain. But I mean, it's not even known in parts of the country, or hardly known.
Well, now in your book, you deal with the traditional cuisine of Castilla-La Mancha, and we've had a number of guests on who've talked about. Traditional Spanish cuisine, but also Spain is, for in many ways, the heart of high-end cooking today, in both its traditional type of cuisine and also in very avant-garde cuisine, which is
very yeah. Uh-huh.
So you know, you now have a situation where young French chefs are going to Spain to learn the craft, you know, and then taking it back. So what is your take on Spanish avant-garde cuisine versus, you know, traditional Spanish cuisine?
Well, it's exciting. It's tremendously exciting. But, of course, it's sort of like, like Ferran Adrià in Catalonia is sort of to Spanish cuisine like Picasso is to art. I
yeah.
mean, he
mm-hmm.
is an artist, a creative genius. And there are others also who are doing fantastic things. And it's exciting. And it's important to Spanish cuisine. But it's still not what people cook at home.
Right. Well, you couldn't cook it at home.
Pretty much what I concentrate on. It's more home cooking and the small family restaurant cooking, tapa bars, that sort of thing. That's the recipes that are in my book are more accessible, I think, than that high cuisine.
Well, most of us don't have industrial lasers in our home.
Right.
You know, so that's
I don't even have a foam machine to make all those.
So talk to us about what's in your book. What kind of dishes can people look for in your book that they can make at home that you think can get them a little bit of the feel of the flavors of Castilla-La Mancha here in America in their homes?
Right. Well, one of my favorite recipes is just incredibly simple. It's garlic soup, which starts with olive oil from Spain, mm-hmm. extra virgin olive oil. You sauté the garlic, whole garlic, in the oil. You add chunks of bread. And then some good chicken stock. And the stock almost soaks up most of the bread, so it's a very thick soup. And then you poach eggs in it. It also has pimentón. Pimentón is Spanish paprika, mm-hmm. and it can be either regular paprika, or it can be smoked. And the smoked paprika even gives it another dimension of flavor. And I think garlic soup is, well, it's a winter dish, yes. I'm not sure whether you want it in a hot New Jersey June day.
Oh, I do.
We'll wait for a cool day. Oh. Wait for a nice breezy day.
Oh, I do. Right. I do. Well, you know, and it's funny because people think, and we see a lot because Jersey has in the Northeast has such amazing tomatoes of gazpacho as the archetypal Spanish soup.
Gazpacho is Andalusian.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
Now, there is a La Mancha dish that's called gazpachos plural. And it obviously comes from the same root, but it's very different. This one appears in the poultry chapter of recipes and not the soups because it's a stew, which is then thickened with pieces of a kind of bread called torta.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what makes it similar to gazpacho, the cold tomato soup, is that it has bread in it.
Mm-hmm.
But it is a stew made with rabbit or partridge or chicken, in this case, if you want to make substitutions.
Yeah, that's probably easier to find around Central Jersey than a partridge.
Right, yeah.
You know, the partridge section of my
Actually,
local supermarket.
These days,
right.
The rabbits are running wild. You can probably find a rabbit very easily.
If you got a gun.
Yeah, it was an old shepherd's dish is what it was, that they would, you know, go shoot their partridge or their rabbit and then cook it over the campfire, and the bread that went into it was a campfire bread too.
Mm-hmm.
And that's gazpacho's plural, and it's definitely the signature dish of La Mancha.
Now in La Mancha, as in most of Spain, as I sort of alluded to earlier, people dine very late. I mean, if you go to dinner at 9:30 in Madrid or in Toledo, you'll be dining with a bunch of Germans, British, and Americans
right.
All sitting around the Spanish restaurant. Then when you leave, the Spanish will come in for dinner at 11 o'clock.
That's right, yeah.
Now, where does that come from, and how does that affect the culture? And I mean, you lived in both the United States and in Spain. I mean, how do you talk to us about the difference in timing and lifestyle.
Well, by now, it's just sort of embedded in the culture. But I think that it originally came from the very hot summers, so you worked... You worked, like in the summer, for example, you work as long as it's daylight. And then when it's finally not daylight, then you have your evening meal. But that could be 10 o'clock. So
mm-hmm.
I think the evening meal became later and later due to the just the climactic conditions.
And you know, it can get pretty darn hot in the summertime.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to be eating a big meal like in the middle of the day. You know, it would be a weird breakup of the day. But
actually, Spaniards do take their main meal at midday.
Right. Well,
unless
they're
working out in the fields.
But I think that there's a cultural impact on dining late at night. That you
yes.
know Americans who want to dine at 6:30, 7 o'clock. It's just not as much fun, you know, as dining out late at night.
Well, we go to bed earlier. But we don't get a nap in the middle of the day either.
Yeah.
Yes, now, there's the thing. Of course, the midday meal is quite late in the day, too. They call it midday, mediodía, but it's actually 2 o'clock in the afternoon. That's when the main meal would occur.
Mm-hmm.
And they also say that you never eat things like beans and lentils at night, nor paella. Paella has to be eaten in the afternoon.
And why is that?
Well, I think it's because they eat so late that those things are considered heavier or not so digestible, and you don't want to eat at 10 o'clock and then go to bed at 12 o'clock and you still haven't digested your supper.
Well, one thing that is similar in Spain and I think throughout most of Europe that's very, very different than the way we eat in the United States is the largest meal of the day in Europe is almost everywhere lunch, where in the United States, for some reason, we've gone to dinner being the largest meal and lunch sometimes just being something you grab and go.
Yeah, very true.
That's because we work too hard.
Yeah, too hard, too much, too often. And, you know, there's a certain, I mean, it's funny. Last time I was in Madrid, I was out quite late at night, and it was just sort of just after dinner for most Spaniards, and I was walking down a street called Gran Vía right in the center, and there were, like, old people and young people out.
Gran Vía, what's that mean?
The big street.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. When we come back, we're going to be talking more with Jana Mendel. Her book is Cooking from the Heart of Spain, The Food of La Mancha. Back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:45.
Let me talk to you about lighting, and specifically about how you can enhance the appeal of any space. Lighting is a powerful, emotional, and aesthetic force. It's one of the most important elements of design. More than anything else, it sets the mood and tone for an entire experience. A room pops or it doesn't, based on lighting. Lights on 9 is a top-notch commercial and retail lighting supplier. Lights on Nine supplied all the lights for our award-winning Catherine Lombardi restaurant, inside and out, dining room and kitchen. Lights on Nine has everything from tasteful and stylish chandeliers to table and floor lamps to outdoor lighting for illuminating a building or walkway or a sign. At Lights on Nine, the service is exemplary, expert, and knowledgeable. They ship anywhere in the continental United States for free. Their retail store is in the Galleria Shopping Center on Route 9 in Manalapan. They're open 7 days a week. Call them at 732-308-9166. That's 732-308-9166. Or visit them at lightson9.com. That's lightson9.com.
Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurant. Our guest today is Janet Mendel. Her book is Cooking from the Heart of Spain, The Food of La Mancha. You know, now, Janet, with this book, one of the things that I think is very interesting is with each new section, you sort of contextualize it and you provide some stories. Why the stories? What role do you think the stories play in your book?
Yeah, I like to be able to tell where food comes from. And so the anecdotes are stories about picking saffron, which we talked about, trout fishing, even a partridge shoot, making marzipan in Toledo, the winemaking, artisanal cheesemaker.
Do you think, I think that really adds to the, when you try and cook these things at home, to have it contextualized in that.
Yeah, it gives the foods a sense of place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
One of the things that you talked about in the beginning of the show was Manchego cheese. Can you talk about the importance of Manchego cheese for this region?
Right. Well, this is where real Manchego is made. It comes from the milk of sheep of the Manchega breed. It can only be, if it has denomination of origin, the cheese, it has to be from the Manchega breed of sheep, and it can be artisanal, which means it comes from unpasteurized milk, or industrial, which is from pasteurized milk.
Mm-hmm.
And it must be aged a minimum of 60 days. So there's no such thing as a fresh cheese. It's always either semi-cured or very well cured.
But we couldn't bring an unpasteurized cheese in the country that's aged under 60 days anyway.
In this country.
Right. In this country. It's in the United States.
Right. But most of what you're buying in America actually is the pasteurized milk.
Yeah, sure. Sadly. Quite sadly.
So one of the things that this area of Spain is also known for is its baked goods. Can you talk to us a little bit about baked goods and some of the things?
Yeah, and interestingly enough, it isn't just baked goods, but it's also fried goods. A lot of the sweets and pastries, yes, there are baked goods, cakes and cookies of various sorts, but also there's a whole tradition of fried sweets, somewhat like donuts, but they may be, some of them are shaped like flowers or leaves or rosettes or twists, and these are fried in olive oil and then dipped in either a honey syrup or in sprinkled with sugar. And they're lovely. They're special for holidays, in fact, of any sort. I mean, even summer holidays. They're even mentioned in the story of Don Quixote.
Is La Mancha where churros come from?
I don't know if they're certainly served there.
I know
churros come from all over.
The churro and chocolate are when you get up in the morning in Madrid, the churros are like they're long sticks of fried donuts, and usually the ones you get around here are weak imitations, and they're done fresh,
right.
And you dip them in hot chocolate, which in Spain is not like the hot chocolate you have here. It's
thick like pudding, isn't it?
Yeah, it's great. It's like a melted shopping bar. It's absolutely delicious.
There's a recipe for that in this book,
It'll kill you, but it's worth it.
Oh, you know, chocolate's good for you. We've established that.
But
sure.
you'll die happy. You know, in when I was in Madrid, when I was a young man, when I was first traveling in Madrid, I remember that I stayed in a youth hostel. We'd stay out all night long, and we would you know, party until the break of dawn almost, and I would go to bed. And then I stayed in a hostel, well, not a youth hostel, but a cheap hotel right across from a panaderia, which was a bread bakery.
Yeah.
And so they would start baking the bread at 6 in the morning, and I'd wake up to the sounds of bread. And then there was a posteria right next to it. So the bakeries in Spain are separated from the bread bakeries, and the pastry bakeries are different places.
Often, yes. Often a panaderia will just prepare bread. That's true. Some of them do both.
But in the cities, you'll see one of these every two blocks. I mean, they're all over
right.
the place.
And the bread is prepared with daily and with no preservatives or anything to keep. There's no fat in it, real Spanish country bread. And so it doesn't keep well. But the thing is, I mean, you buy it fresh every day, you eat it fresh, and then any that's left goes into these mini dishes, such as gazpacho that we mentioned and such as the garlic soup.
Right.
There are dozens more. There's a wonderful dish called migas, which are a little bit like, it's a shepherd's dish. It's a little bit like hash browned bread cubes, really, breadcrumbs that have been fried in olive oil with garlic and bits of chorizo sausage. And this is can be served as a breakfast dish, or it can be served as a side dish, or even, for example, instead of your dressing with your holiday turkey.
Now, in the book, you've read a number of times, and I thought it was very telling. You wrote that you find that La Mancha is the land of surprises. What do you find so surprising? What things do you find that jump out and surprise you about La Manchan cuisine?
Well, for one thing, it's very green. Even though La Mancha, by the way, comes from the Arabic, which means al manchara, meaning an arid, dry land. And considering that it is that dry, it's surprising to see that it's very green, and that's because of the extension of the vineyards. The grapevines stay green all through this hot summer. They begin to turn color then in the fall. So you'll see great swaths of green vineyards, and also wetlands that bubble up from underground rivers, and these wetlands with ducks. So it's quite surprising, and also waterfalls and cliffs and things that you don't expect on a flat plateau.
Well, it's an amazing place to visit, and if you can't get there, you can at least have the food of La Mancha or make your own attempt to approximate it with her book, Cooking from the Heart of Spain. You can find out about that on our website, restaurantguysradio.com. Hey, Janet, thanks for being on the show with us.
Well, thanks. It's nice to talk to you.
Thanks, Janet.
Enjoy.
When we come back, actually, I'm going to talk a little bit about Spanish wines that you can find that are very durable and from the wines from different regions of Spain that are Jerez de la Frontera, which is where sherry comes from. There's some amazing stuff going on down there. We'll talk about that in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:55. Hello, everyone, and welcome back. You're listening to Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys, the Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurant. Our guest today was Janet Mendel. Her book is Cooking from the Heart of Spain, Food of La Mancha, which is a great cookbook if you want to pick it on up. As you know, I spent a lot of time in Spain, or did when I was younger, before I started working in restaurants all the time. But I still go back.
Before you worked 100 hours a week.
But I still go back, and I remember when I was a young man, one of the most striking things I've ever seen were the vineyards in Jerez de la Frontera, which is the region in the south of Spain, full city. And there are two towns down there. One is Sanlúcar de Barrameda, and one is Jerez de la Frontera. And those are two towns where sherry comes from. Sherry is actually an Anglicanization of Jerez. Jerez is sherry. So it gets so hot down there. It's one of the hottest wine-producing regions in the world. And it's so dry.
It's not as hot as India.
It's not as hot as India, which is the hottest wine-producing region in the world. But it gets so hot and it's so dry and the soil is so chalky that in the summertime what happens is the reason the grapevines can survive this incredibly hot summer is that the white chalk basically bakes to a crust over the entire vineyard.
Like, think of a salt cod.
Exactly. It's like a crust of salt. It's a crust of chalk that it's literally you hit it with a hammer to get through it. And that protects the vineyards, the root system of the vines, which allows the wines of sherry to grow. And it's also the most striking thing you'll ever see. You look at this vineyard, and the floor, it's like it's growing out of a marble floor. It's absolutely incredible.
That's really cool.
And I recommend. And the other thing is, if you want to try visiting down that area of Jerez, that's a less touristed area than much of Spain.
And in a future show, we'll talk some more about sherry and the different kinds of sherries there are.
Yeah.
There's dry, there's sweet, there are all kinds of different sherries. I think everybody kind of has their, whether you were a Harvey's Bristol Cream drinker or a dry sack drinker, you have your preconceived notions. There's a lot of sherry.
There's a lot of real top quality sherry coming out of there. And, you know, like the Harvey's Bristol and the dry sack is like the Gallo Hardy Burgundy of sherry. But it's really wonderful. Everything from dry to sweet, and it actually goes well with food and certainly before and after dinner. So we'll talk more about that in a future show. But if you're looking to visit a European country that's very friendly, Spain, totally, totally recommend it. Madrid and Jerez de la Frontera. I hope you've enjoyed the hour listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 12 noon.